This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show, if you can believe it. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
A set designer of the 1950s might struggle to recognize the television news desks of today. Gone are the still backgrounds and plywood set pieces. Now, just about every surface is a customizable screen.
As the way that we report the news changes, so has the design of the sets from which it's broadcast and the on-screen graphics that accompany the shows. We take a closer look at the headlines in the world of set design. Plus...
We're sort of living in smaller and smaller spaces with these animals, trying to figure out how to make furniture that brings them closer to the family, but also is better for the interior space as well.
What can designers learn by looking at life through the eyes of a goldfish or a golden retriever? We fetch a little inspiration from architecture for animals. Then press on for a few answers from a new generation of Beirutese screen printers. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, the world's leading television trade fair, MIPCOM, wrapped up in Cannes last week. And while streaming platforms and other distribution channels might have been front and centre on La Croisette, another subtler shift is taking place on our screens. TV news has undergone a remarkable, if incremental, transformation over the past two decades. A genre that was once dominated by nightly bulletins, usually presented from behind a desk by a baritone brogued and avuncular newscaster, is now under pressure to be cleverer with its storytelling. Gone are the days of wobbly backdrops and anchors chained to their chairs. Now, TV news sets play an active role in the presentation of the story, as Monocle's Ben Ryland discovered when he visited Bloomberg's recent Sterling Prize-winning European headquarters here in London.
From NBC News, this is Today with Bryant Gumbel and Jane Pauley.
It's the 5th of October, 1989. Viewers across the United States are waking up with Today. The Today Show, that is. NBC's flagship morning program, the first of its kind. As clips of the day's news cut away, the show's hosts are revealed, seated at the main desk. A small panel-style arrangement, just enough room for four people, two main hosts, a news presenter, and the weatherman. Behind the show's anchors, Jane Pauley and Bryant Gumbel, is a sun styled as the program's logo, which remains today, and a still background of New York City.
How would you like to make $1,000? Anybody interested in $1,000?
Sure.
There's a reward out there. A cockatoo is missing in St. Louis.
Lady, the design of television news remained remarkably traditional throughout the 20th century. With few exceptions, a man sat at a desk in front of a still background reading the news. Then, as the 21st century opened the door to an age of dizzying technological advancements, the news started to look different. Flagship evening bulletins from the United States to Australia and the UK ditched some of their on-screen graphics in favour of large on-set screen panels. Cameras were pulled back, revealing the presenter's hands and arms, sometimes for the first time, while also turning the art of newsreading into a form of physical choreography.
It is 11 a.m. in New York, 4 p.m. in London, and 11 p.m. in Hong Kong. Welcome to the Bloomberg Market Day.
A set designer of the 1950s might struggle to recognize the television news desks of today. Gone are the still backgrounds and plywood set pieces. Now, just about every surface is a customizable screen. This isn't technology for technology's sake, however. It's all about finding new ways of telling a story and, in a rapidly changing business, streamlining the process. Luke Morano is global editor at Bloomberg TV.
I think the first thing to recognise about Bloomberg is that at the very centre of Bloomberg, and I mean Bloomberg, the company, not just Bloomberg Television, is data and processing data and the analytics around data. And that is one of the key parts of Bloomberg Television as well. It's what really gives us our competitive advantage. We speak to newsmakers, lots of people speak to newsmakers, but they don't have the access to the data that we do. So that's what makes the real difference. In terms of how that matches in with the Bloomberg brand, the other part role that I think the studio plays is there's a consistency to it. It has a very slick feel. You feel, hopefully, that you're watching cutting-edge technology being deployed. Also because we're a global company, and that's something that we're very proud of, there is a level of consistency in the various sets around the world, but also a key part of it is to give a feeling of the localized location. So if you actually look at our set, it would have been very easy to basically build a dark box and just fill it full of video screens in the background and see nothing more. But if you actually look at the way our set works, and hopefully your listeners will be acquainted with it, whilst there are many display surfaces in it, it's crucial to us that you also actually get to see the office behind it. It needs to feel like a living thing. And Bloomberg is a very big company, but journalistically, we're also very large. There are 2,700 journalists around the world, 120 different countries. So showing that there is that force behind the product, the TV that we're making, is very important. So hopefully a viewer watching that will see that translate, even if it doesn't sort of smack them in the face as the undertone to it.
Standing here on the set at Bloomberg's European headquarters in London, it's easy to see why they might want to show off a little. The building, designed by Foster and Partners, just won 2018's Stirling Prize. But the set isn't simply a desk plonked amongst a few workstations. Stepping onto the large circular space is almost like boarding a flying saucer. The main desk floats above a video floor, while large screens suspended from tracks mounted on the ceiling allow backgrounds and graphics to seamlessly move away from the desk. With every surface being a video screen, there's no need for sets to be bumped in and out with show schedules. Walls, floors, colours and textures are redressed at the push of a button.
That's one of the luxuries of getting to design a set from the ground up. And in the years when this building was being put together and we were actually looking at what we wanted to do, we knew that, again, coming back to what I was saying, one of the key things that Bloomberg does is deal with data. And data can be the story, but you need to be able to show that in a compelling way. So we knew from the start that we would want a lot of display surfaces. As we were sort of going through the process, what would happen is various show producers, various people across editorial would sort of pipe up with, hey, it would be really cool if it could do this, or it'd be really cool if you could have these screens that slide around, or what about these ones that move in and out? And all of those kind of got chucked into the sort of wish list. And then what we've ended up with, which, as you said, is a very versatile space. So it allows us during the course of a day to shoot a number of different shows that all have their own sort of unique look and feel. When we come up to our market open show, so it starts at 7:30, the European equity markets open at 8 a.m. So for us, that's a real build-up of energy. And if you look at how we deploy the set, in those shows, what you'll actually see is a lot more of the set. You'll be able to see us putting graphics into the floor, into the screens around the outside, into the radials that can move in and out. And those wide shots, again, as you see the anchor move from one position to another position, it kind of helps build up that energy. As the day goes on, and once you get sort of, I don't know, 9 a.m. when our surveillance show comes on, by that stage in the day, if you follow sort of consumers' patterns and how news cycles works, we're then in the position where we want to take a more sort of more of a step back look at the day. We'll know that there are three or so stories that we want to hone in on. The set is then able to become a far more sort of intimate space for longer conversations that are really probing deeper into the subjects. But this office as a whole is, in a sense, our set. We're able to put wireless cameras in various positions.
The building also boasts some of the best views in London. You'd struggle to find a dull corner.
One of the best views, I think, which is up on the 8th floor, we actually have a soft set for one-on-one interviews that looks directly out over St. Paul's. So all of, again, going back to that wish list, somehow, miraculously, we kind of got exactly what we wanted.
Since the days of crackly black and white bulletins, news producers have understood the power of a setting to tell a story. There's a reason the news almost always involves a desk, while a talk show often takes place on a sofa, and morning programs always ensure that the branded coffee cups are in shot. Just like a movie, there's a scene being set here and a story to tell. There's an awful lot of programming being broadcast out of Bloomberg's London studios. But to the casual observer here on set, you might not realise just how often we see the same few metres of streamlined space. Even the cameras are automated robots. So, is this video screen set design the way of the future for television news?
I'd be surprised if not, to be honest. It's all about sort of economies, isn't it? If I can build one space that does it all, or I could build three discrete spaces, each one for a specific purpose, or one is going to take you more space and you're going to have to build them all. We're in a breaking news situation. Press that button and then the studio will configure itself in a certain way. Cameras will whiz off to the correct framing. For television news, which is basically a product that you're churning out hour after hour, day after day, then it does make sense. You still, I think, there will, of course, still be place for sort of marquee shows or important news interviews. And how do you differentiate those? Yes, if you can make your set look different, I mean, this kind of takes it into the realms of virtual studios. There are those possibilities, but also being sat in front of a beautiful view in the outdoors or something for a certain type of show may make more sense. And I think the viewer will actually notice it. And once everyone starts doing the same thing again, people start to repackage what they used to do and it kind of looks new.
This style of highly versatile video screen set may indeed be the way forward. But as Luke says, it's only as effective as the story it's telling. And in an ever more crowded media landscape, standing out is more important than ever. Though that's unlikely to be much of a challenge for this building. For Monocle, at Bloomberg's European headquarters in London, I'm Ben Rylan.
Now, silkscreen printing has a bad reputation in some quarters through associations with mass production and the limited colour palettes that the technique makes necessary. But a new shop-come studio in the Lebanese capital of Beirut is encouraging small-scale production on fabric, glass and paper. Our correspondent in the city, Lizzie Porter, explores the attraction of small print runs and one-off projects in a city where working in this environment can be challenging, to say the least.
Silkscreen is really cool because it can either be extremely like industrial and impersonal, or it can be really artistic, very experimental and really free. And you're using the same tools to create both those kinds of, like the entire array between those two extremes.
Farah Fayed is showing me a quirky poster of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. His face has been printed onto a pink chair above the words, "Ceci n'est pas une chaise." In this instance, the famous words of Belgian surrealist painter René Magritte, "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," make for wry political commentary on the Egyptian military chief turned statesman. He has hardly taken a backseat when it comes to cracking down on civil freedoms. On a shelf next to us, green glass bottles have been recycled into jars for tea, sugar and salt. Bold white Arabic lettering indicates what goes in each container. We're in Farah's new shop, Nice Nice Prints. It opened in June in the attractive Beirut district of Mono. We're standing amongst posters, t-shirts, tote bags and glassware, all made and designed in Lebanon in small production runs, sometimes as low as six. Every item for sale here has been finished with silkscreen printing. The technique involves forcing paint through a mesh screen onto fabric, canvas and other materials. Farah has even experimented with balloons. Patterns are formed by way of stencils, and multiple colours can be printed on the same surface using separate screens. The name reflects how the screens used to be fashioned from silk mesh, but nowadays polyester is far more common. Although artists like Andy Warhol popularised the technique in the mid-20th century, more recently, digital printing has threatened it with the promise of wider colour palettes. But Farah is clearly passionate about the technique.
There are a lot of things that can be achieved in screen printing that cannot be achieved digitally, especially when we're printing on textile. So I think this is something that, I mean, the demand is never going to run out. And I mean, in certain things like newspapers or content that you just need to read on a daily basis, of course, I mean, it's more practical for a lot of people to just get that content online on their like iPads or whatever it is. But if when you have a limited edition print, a lot of people just generally appreciate, they either appreciate that or they don't. And we're lucky enough to have a lot of people in Beirut that really do appreciate these things. So it's really important for us to keep doing this work.
Back at Nice Nice Prints, Farah's passion for silkscreen is promoting the work of local artists too. The CC poster is by Hamid Sino, a graphic designer and lead singer of Lebanese indie rock band Mashru Layla. A poster by illustrator Rana Zaha shows the Mesopotamian goddess Ishtar. A t-shirt plays on the theme of Lebanon's frequent power cuts, fractious politics, and poor infrastructure.
One of the things that we like to focus on is Arabic typography. So there are a few things that are like Arabic-based, like this poster, which says Beirut.
Oh, yeah, and I can see. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like a lettering that is meant to resemble tires. And then here it says, "Intofet u wilat," which means it's like on fire and then out. And we printed this with glow-in-the-dark ink to kind of work with the with the theme. So if you turn off the lights, Beirut and Wilayat, which means it caught fire, will glow in the dark. And then Tufit, which means it was like put out, will stay, like, will, you know, won't show.
Farah has also started workshops at Nice Nice, using the space's custom-made printing table.
I mean, for us, this project really isn't about making money. It's more about teaching people this craft, giving them a space to work so people can come rent the space, produce their own objects. We've also been giving workshops. So yeah, we just want to build a nice community around screen printing.
That desire is partly because crafts in Lebanon have a fragile future. Farah is very aware that many of the country's older masters have not passed traditions down to their children.
Most of them haven't taught their children their crafts, but they would rather like encourage their children to go to universities and learn other kinds of domains and whatnot. So really, a lot of these things are dying, and this is, I mean, it might be like nostalgic and a bit sad, but I personally think it's really important to revive, to rethink, to re-question, and not just keep doing the same things all the time. So yeah, this is what we want to do here.
There are some exceptions to the trend of older workers not passing on their skills. Farah's partner at Nice Nice Prints is Salim Samara, who's been interested in silkscreen printing since he was a boy. In the 1980s, during the Lebanese Civil War, he started his own business. He now owns a printworks, SS Silkscreen, where most of the first Nice Nice product runs were printed. There, the team can work using oil-based paints, which Farah wants to avoid, in the retail space.
So going down the stairs in an old apartment block. Oh wow, I can smell the, yeah, I can smell the thinner of a, definitely some fumes in here. Marhaba.
SS Silkscreen is filled with mesh screens and pots of paint. A wall is covered with t-shirts and posters printed for clients past and present. The workshop contains a mixture of automatic and hand-operated machines. The larger ones fulfill Salim's bigger orders. While smaller ones and limited editions, like those for Nice Nice Prints, are completed on entirely manual machines. Salim says even putting the screen in place is done by hand. And although he does take on larger orders, Salim finds something special in the small-scale product runs.
The great thing in this work is that there are always new things. The large orders become very routine. You're printing the same thing all day, 4,000 times maybe. It's normal screen printing. But we love the special projects. Sometimes you're working on t-shirts, other times on stickers, other times on cardboard, glass, plexi. You don't see every printworks printing on everything. Our clients come in and we say to them, you dream and we do all the work. We can't tell them more than that.
As Farah commissions new designs for Nice Nice Prints, Salim's son is learning from his father.
Okay, first thing, اسمي روني سمارة ابن سليم سمارة.
My name is Roni, the son of Salim Samara. I'm 18 years old. I'm Lebanese-Romanian. I love this work because it has an art to it, and I love art. From when I was young, When I was 6 years old, this interested me, and I would stay in this place among the machines. I love things done by hand. There are so many attractive details in silkscreen, and it is very rich. There are many artists who like it, and we help them as much as we can. It is a really lovely technique.
There is a market for high-quality, hand-produced prints in Lebanon. But the country's political and economic instability make long-term planning difficult.
And what are the challenges you come up against working in Beirut specifically?
The economy is weird. There's all kinds of like political turmoil all the time. So what we try to do is, we live in a bubble somehow, of course. And that has its, negatives and positives somehow. It allows us to keep working and moving forward. But it's also really risky because you never know when something really bad might happen. And this is something we all grew up thinking.
Still, Farah and Salim are determined to keep the industry alive in Lebanon. Here's Salim again.
Even in silk screening now, there's digital. But the thing is that in digital, you can't identify the machinery and the mechanics. You can't distinguish the work you did. You don't toil over it. With silk screening, you can draw something by hand and print it using the screen. With silk screen, we did it. We achieved something from it.
Nice Nice Prints is attracting a clientele that looks beyond mass-produced objects. And with no shortage of talented local designers to provide the artwork, and Farah and Salim's printing skills, the screen, it seems, is the limit. For Monocle, in Beirut, I'm Lizzie Porter.
From playful so-called cat trees to concrete dog homes and swanky chicken coops, there's a new book out that explores examples of clever and sometimes humorous architecture made with pets in mind. Monocle's Daphne Carnesa spoke to Virginia McLeod, the commissioning editor at Fiden, along with editor Tom Wainwright about their book Pettecture.
For a long time, for hundreds of years, we've had cages and beds that have essentially just been padding for whether it's a dog or a cat, and they've sort of just been the bare minimum. And I feel like there's been a certain shift, and we're now sort of treating pets similar to the way we treat like our kids, like part of the family now. They would just think every design we came across, just every design now is sort of treated with as much respect as you would by any short human furnishings. But I think that was discovered along the way.
Yeah. You said that we're treating our pets more and more like part of the family. Do you think that's also to do with the way that we're living as humans? We're living in smaller and smaller spaces, so we're in much closer proximity with our pets.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the designs were very conscious of, as you were saying, how we're living now. So we're sort of living in smaller and smaller spaces with these animals, trying to figure out how to make furniture that it brings them closer to the family, but also is better for the interior space as well.
And I think in a lot of cultures, whether not just Western cultures either, and not just rich cultures, that animals, especially small domestic pets like cats and dogs, are really being treated like parts of the family more than ever before. There's some sort of fantastical statistic about Korea that there's, I don't know, two pets to every one person or something. And they're really part of the family in terms of clothing and bedding, and the way they're looked after and loved is as much as any other human in their family. So, you know, these sorts of designs that we see in the book are sort of catering to that, the way that people really feel about animals. And I think the Mahatma Gandhi quote that's in the book, something to do with a measure of a society's progress and like moral performance can be seen in the way they treat their animals. So I think many countries can be very proud of themselves, including this one, in that we do that.
Some of the objects and designs, it's obvious what their aim is. For example, shelter, or as you say, cooling, quite functional and actually, you know, do have an impact on the well-being of the animal. But others might be slightly more whimsical and maybe more for the amusement of humans. So where do you think that the value line lies, and is it kind of a thin line?
I know the kind of project that you're talking about in the book, and there's a good few of them, because for some reason a lot of people are using pets and their place in our world as a kind of a jumping off point to explore ideas and to express them through like art projects. But I think a lot of those art projects, which may look a little far-fetched or even a little confrontational, are often meant as kind of sculptural designs, not actually meant for a pet to sort of inhabit them.
The bullet birdhouse, for example,
yes,
it's more of a sculptural piece.
It's more of a sculptural piece, and it's also to kind of protest illegal hunting in the Lebanon. So they're made of bullets that are picked up on old hunting grounds, so it's making its point through a very beautiful object. Other things that are to raise money and awareness for feral cats and stray dogs and all sorts of things like that. So often they might look impractical, or, you know, why on earth would you put a pet in something like this? But it's actually not intended for that. It's intended to make a point and raise awareness.
What do you guys think that a designer can learn by, I guess, seeing things through the perspective of a cat or a goldfish or a bird?
I think an architect or a designer, an artist, a lot of the items in the book are from artists, and these designs can really help an artist or an architect like look to their future designs, because what you're doing is you're sort of scaling back what is pet texture, what is a design for a pet, and you're trying to think about what would be the best thing for it. Like, what, it's quite lovingly made, and it essentially all the projects, I'd say, have got an element of love put into them for a species, for another, their own pet, or for animals at large. And I think from that loving standpoint, I think it might inform future designs, perhaps, and reevaluate how we not only look after ourselves but these animals as well.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. If a cat or a dog, in particular, sort of like household domestic type pets, as opposed to sheep or horses, say, who have a slightly different relationship to people. If you're an artist or a designer or an architect creating something for them, like a habitat of some kind, then it's just life in miniature or a commission in miniature. So you're still thinking about similar sorts of things to make them comfortable, warm enough, and so on, in the same way that they might go on to design something for a human.
One of the things I noticed with the designs is that a lot of designs are very conscious about the ecological aspect of their design. So a lot of them are recycled. A lot of the materials used and a lot of the projects have been upcycled or recycled. Lots of the felt was made out of, well, felt-like material was used out of recycled plastic bottles. Or one design in particular was used out of an old air conditioning unit as well. I thought it was quite a nice trend to see that a lot of people were taking into consideration environmental aspects of it as well.
That was Tom Wainwright, project editor of the book Pet Texture, and Virginia McLeod, commissioning editor at Fiden. Their book is available at all self-respecting bookshops now. Sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, The Wonderful On Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could also, if you fancied it, pick up a copy of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, one of our many seasonal newspapers, or the libraries of books that we publish on all subjects, from the home to the world of architecture and design. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.